You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's passage is Luke's account of Jesus returning to his hometown of Nazareth. Luke's version is much longer and more elaborate than the parallel passages in Mark and Matthew, who just say he taught in the synagogue. A couple of things to keep in mind as you listen to this passage. First off, Nazareth is a tiny town of maybe a couple of dozen families of dirt-poor subsistence farmers or peasants. So put out of your mind any thought of a separate building that was reserved to be called the synagogue. This is a mistaken thought that is shared by Luke. Synagogue just means gathering. So picture instead the village square or a rough space that's created between houses. Another thing to think about is that scholars are in disagreement as to whether Jesus could actually read or write. Mark and Matthew just have Jesus teaching in the synagogue, no reading. But leave it to the academic Luke to assume that Jesus was a scholar who could read classic Hebrew, which was unlikely for someone of Jesus' upbringing. Finally, Luke gives himself away as A, not being Jewish, and B, being willing to manipulate the facts in having Jesus read stuff from Isaiah that's not really there. Since healing the blind is such an important element of Luke's Jesus, Luke has Jesus read that Isaiah proclaims healing of the blind as one of the characteristics of the Anointed One. Convenient for Luke's story, but sadly, not in Isaiah. Oops. After Jesus reads from the scroll, he takes his seat and announces that Isaiah's prophetic words are fulfilled in his own person. While at first people are intrigued by the possibility, when they think about the implications, they get a little nervous and decide it would be safer to just run him out of town.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke 4:16-21. When Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written.
The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because God has appointed me to bring good news to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor.
And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them,
"Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing."
Here's what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
So, any idea what phrase appears most frequently in Hebrew scripture? Any guesses? Well, it's "do not be afraid." Yeah, and that's probably because the second most frequently recorded phrase in Hebrew scripture is the admonition to care for the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. And that can be scary. The prophets tell us that the duty of the people of God is to care about and be advocates for the poor and powerless. It should be no surprise, then, that according to the Gospels, Jesus' first concern is for those in the community who are most vulnerable and who have no voice. What you have in our passage today is Jesus channeling Isaiah and that same passion that underlies all of Hebrew Scripture to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, and to set at liberty those who are oppressed. And while it's clear that the prophets and Jesus and other biblical sources make care for the downtrodden the duty of the people of God, it usually gets pretty short shrift. It's always been so much easier to make the spiritual life about following the rules and embracing whatever priorities the community deems as reputable. That's one of the reasons the church is usually associated with acts of loving kindness and mission, feeding the homeless, handing out lunches, painting houses, filling flood buckets. It's all great. But we're talking about something a little different today. We're talking about justice, mishpat in Hebrew. Now, I've talked about this before, but in light of the protests and calls for justice that we've seen spreading around the globe, I wanted to make sure that we took a moment to reclaim the definition of justice from how we often hear it used, essentially as a euphemism for revenge. Justice will be done. Biblical justice, mishpat, is about fairness and equality. It's about righteousness. It's about being in right relationship with the divine and with others. Especially in light of the outpouring of grief and anger following the death of George Floyd, it's important for us to remember that justice involves each of us living in such a way that is deeply respectful of the dignity of others and is willing to work to make sure that we recognize injustice wherever it's been allowed to flourish. If Jesus scholar Dom Crossan were here, he would want me to make a very important distinction here. There are two kinds of justice. First is individual justice. I don't cheat you, and you don't defraud me. But then there's systemic and structural justice. It's the line item, he says, in a federal budget that guarantees that 500,000 kids will be hurt 6 months from now, and sort of nobody did it. It just sort of happened. What we've seen glaringly exposed in the deaths of so many of our Black brothers and sisters is the systemic and structural injustice of our system. And the bottom line is that without justice, human beings cannot live together as God intended, plain and simple. And acting for justice isn't just about comforting those who are victims of injustice. It's about making a commitment to mending the system which has injustice baked in. And this is where things become more complicated and emotional for many people. Because what may need to be done may involve politics. Catholic Bishop Dom Helder Câmara of Brazil experienced this phenomena firsthand when he began to speak out for social reforms in his country. He said, "When I gave food to the poor, they called me a saint. When I began to ask why there were so many poor, they called me a communist." If you take the Bible seriously, you can't miss the fact that Jesus was profoundly political, calling out economic injustice, discrimination, and while different in his day than in ours, the evil that Reverend Jim Wallace calls America's original sin of racism. Back in 1949, South Pacific was a huge hit on Broadway, but then it ran into problems. When the national tour was announced, there were states like Georgia that actually attempted to pass legislation to ban its performance. It seems that the interracial romances that are depicted in the musical ran contrary to the norms of many communities where good Christians enforced that which made their Christianity even purer, segregation. Another big problem, the song "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught."
"What makes her talk like that? Why do you have this feeling, you and she? I do not believe it is born in you. I do not believe it.
It's not born in you. It happens after you're born.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late. Before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
Many communities tried to stipulate that when the show played in their town, "You've got to be carefully taught" be removed. But Rodgers and Hammerstein insisted that if the song wasn't sung, then the show wouldn't run. Truth be told, we have been carefully taught in our culture to disrespect, mistreat, dishonor, ignore, and oppress people of any number of races, colors, and creeds. Over and over again, it's the same tired old arguments that we've used on the Irish. Oh no, Catholics, Jews, they're taking over. Germans, damned krauts. The Japanese, they're infiltrators. And are used to this day on African Americans, Hispanics, and Muslims. Let me remind you of the words of Baptist pastor Tony Campolo. "We must preach the whole gospel, which not only calls people to love Jesus, but to bring his justice into the political and economic arena in which we live." If you want to ignore the Bible, just forget everything I've said today. You get a pass. But if you're going to pay attention to the Bible, then you can't avoid the reality that mishpat, or the justness of a society, is measured by how that society treats those with the least economic and social power, those who find themselves fighting against a system that is structured to put them at a disadvantage and make the majority feel better about itself. Last week, our guest speaker, Ahmad Daniels, asked us to be honest with ourselves and examine what we're doing to either keep the world broken or be a part of its healing. That kind of honesty takes courage, and it takes putting love first, which is why I like that Cornel West mantra. Justice is what love looks like in public. Acting for justice is working to make the world the kind of place that reflects the intentions of the Creator, where everyone has what they need to live, where the shalom of God is a present reality, and where everyone lives in right relationship with one another. It goes beyond race and economics to politics, to health care, to neighborhood policing, to child care, to immigration, to the whole of our lives together. As my Hebrew scripture professor Harold Beck used to say, until justice is reflected in the highways and byways, and little children can play in the streets, and old men can sit under the shade tree, and old women don't have to be afraid of whether or not their bank account or Medicare or their illness will outlast the other, we will not have justice. And the Bible dreams of justice in all the simple, common places. We are called to be in relationship with the least of these, and not in a patronizing way, but in genuine relationship, to recognize places of injustice in our communities, to enter into those places when invited, and to be a witness a presence, a voice for justice. That's what it's going to take. And I hope you'll commit to pursuing this call with me. After all, it's what Jesus would do. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.